Right, good evening. We are on our live Q&A call for Saturday 9th of January. My name's Andy Rice from Winchester in the UK, and with me, of course, is Hamish Wilcox, Sunday morning in New Zealand. Good morning, Hamish.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Bright and early over here.
And Hamish, we are always going to be answering questions on any subject that people want to ask about on any of the chapters of Road to Gold. But we are on version one, and we have a lot of people that are working through it week by week as we're launching it. So we're going to major on race speed, part two of our boat speed chapter this week. And as ever, I want to ask you about what's been going on with the America's Cup behind the scenes. There's been a bit of training going on between the challengers, between the Italians, the Americans and the Brits. Now all us armchair experts have been writing off Ben Ainslie and Ineos Team UK, saying they don't stand a hope in hell, but it seems like they've done some hard work. While the rest of us were eating turkey and roast potatoes and Brussels sprouts, they were working hard on sorting out their race package. Where are they at now, do you think?
Yeah, definitely a big improvement. You know, we were watching American Magic and Ineos racing side by side 2 days ago. And, you know, from all accounts, the people watching said that was quite a close match between those two. And most of the, as you say, armchair experts are putting American Magic in the hot seat as the favourite to win the trials at the moment. But of course, a lot happens in a very short time, and it seems the most likely thing is I think they've got their foil arms working much better, and those have been their big breakdown issues right through that Christmas Cup, Prada Cup and Christmas Cup.
They had some breakdown issues with their foil arm on day one of the competition in December, and they put out a press release that was very strongly worded against the suppliers of the foil arm, which effectively was saying Emirates Team New Zealand gave them duff equipment. But there was a very robust response from Emirates Team New Zealand the next day. So I know you're in the ETNZ camp. Was there any legitimate criticism that the Brits put out in that press release, in your view? Or was it sour grapes?
Sure, and I think it's a bit sour grapes, but they're tricky things. They're very complicated boats, and you know, there's a lot of in-house connectivity. Obviously, the foil arms come, you know, as a supplied equipment to everybody, and there's also a huge manual on how you use them and how you shouldn't use them. And I think, you know, like you say, the response was pretty clear to their question. But I think that, you know, you look at a program like America's Cup, it's so complicated. The opportunity for making a massive improvement is there. You can see it even in a one design. You can really feel, you know, your performance curve accelerating in a one design early days, and you can make some pretty big breakthroughs really quickly. And if you can imagine a boat that's not one design, that's most of the components are designed, then the opportunity to make, you know, big gains is even greater. And we're going to see that with new foil arms coming on, with new foils coming on with these teams and new sails. They're going to be big changes in performance.
Philippe Presti, he's the coach to the Italian challenge, Luna Rossa. Now, you will have worked with Philippe in the past, both at Oracle, I think, and he was a great fin sailor in his day as well. And I read an interview with him, which to me was maybe quite enlightening in terms of how much development and gains you can make. Because we've been constantly hearing that if you didn't get these decisions right a year ago, then you're probably too late. But he says, especially since the AC 75s are great boats, but complicated in terms of balance, so that the smallest stability deficit can greatly affect the performance of the boat and hide its true qualities. For example, we saw the British in difficulty in particular because of problems with their canting control system for the foil. And because of this, we didn't really show what they had under the hood. And for us in the Italian camp, we haven't shown our last foils yet. We have three mainsails that are going to arrive full of developments and progress. So what counts here is how the teams will move forward and the rate and magnitude of their progress over the coming weeks. So maybe a small change in one area of the package, and we're talking about the pivot point potentially with race speed and the importance of the pivot point. I suppose the importance of the pivot point that you talk about in relation to simple dinghies like 470s and lasers, maybe that's even more important and even more critical in foiling.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is critical, but it's in a dinghy, it's manageable, as you said. We can adjust that all the time, constantly do with, you know, with a big boat, you know, like the America's Cup, really complicated. You know, you've got your pivot arms, you know, where the foil arms connect, they're already decided. And so you can, with the foil arm, the attachment of the foil at the bottom of the arm can be moved. So you'll notice that some of the foils are swept well forward of the foil arm and some of the foils are swept well back of the foil arm. And the same with the elevator at the back on the rudder, you can move the elevator. So when someone brings in a new rudder or a new foil arm, you can change the balance subtly with the positioning of the foils on those appendages. There's a lot, and the mainsail and the jibs, it's a lot going on there. You can definitely bring in a significantly better sail that will balance the boat more to get that, you know, as you say, the pivot right. And if you haven't got the pivot right, it would be really, really hard to sail those boats.
Well, anyway, for us Brits, we see some light on the horizon, which we were struggling to find before Christmas. So we have a little bit more hope of seeing a good three-way fight in the Challenger Series. Let's see how that works out. Now, I just see that Sebastian has said Happy New Year. He opened up the chat. And Dominic has come in with our first meaty questions. And I encourage any of you to ask any questions. Let's start with race speed at the moment. Even if you haven't made it through to Chapter 5, or maybe you've only just bought Road to Gold and so you're not familiar with the whole program, I know there's a fear of sticking your hand up and asking what might be a stupid question because we mentioned that in Chapter 1 or whatever. Get over your fear of looking like a fool. We're not going to laugh at you. We appreciate the questions, and we have some fantastic experts within our group here as well as Hamish's expertise as well. So don't be shy. Please do ask any questions, because there are no stupid questions. Let's start with Dominic's. Hello, what options do you see for footers in upwind planing dinghies like 49 and 470, especially at the start where most of the fleet likes or needs to pinch to hold the lane? Usually you go for a slightly different setup, which is not that easy to change. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's absolutely. So many of us can relate to that, Dominic. You want to pull up the board, you want to set up for speed around the racetrack, but everybody else is wanting to pinch like hell out of the line and you're stuck having to stick in the same mode as everybody else. So Hamish, great question to start with.
Yeah, it's really interesting because we're obviously exploring modes like everybody. At the moment, and one of the things that really jumps out to me is that when you go fast, as we did in the 470 back in the 80s, you lose the negative leeway, so you gain a lot with your leeway, and overall our height was equal or better to anyone's in the fleet, but we were going 10% faster. So the VMG, the final result was, you know, with a massive gain. I'm talking about the 470 in the 80s, you know. So what happens is that as the centerboard, as your foils pass through the water, if you're going 10% faster, they're often going to be, you know, way more efficient. It might be a number bigger than 10% of efficiency. And Slingsby was fantastic in the laser at doing the same thing. And as a result, even though the bow is pointing, let's say 10 degrees to make it simple, overall lower to the wind, the foils are passing through the water much faster, and you end up gaining from your leeway. You're losing less. Most boats have about 10% of leeway, 10 degrees of leeway. So you're gaining that back as a overall percentage of VMG could be good. So how do you race, how do you manage that in a race course? And that's a really good question. And for us in the 470, you've got to think about your start. You have to be really good at accelerating off the blocks, and you have to have enough room to leeward to roll that first boat, because as soon as you drop your bow and you accelerate, assuming you can do that better than the boat to leeward, and if you've intimidated enough of those boats over the years, you'll find that there's less and less willing to take the chance to start near you to leeward. And so it sort of snowballs. And then once you get that first boat and you open up the afterburners, you know, everybody's, if you've really got a good low mode, low fast mode, everybody's mincemeat after that. They just start peeling off, you know. So it's really a case of managing your speed, your style of sailing around the fleet, or learning to manage it.
In the 470, you at least have the option to pull up the board if that's one of the mode changes that you make once you've got clear space around you. In the 49er, you might want to have the board higher up once you're in open space for best BMG, for best speed, VMG speed. But you may need that extra board down to get yourself off the start line. So, for example, how do you discuss that with Pete and Blair? Well, how do you train for that, and how does it, what's the decision that's made on race day?
I think the other thing you've got to consider is, you know, when you're in a shifty, gusty kind of venue, day type, it really rewards being fast. So even if you work it out, the science, even if you're like 10 degrees lower, you'll reach in the same speed. So in other words, your VMG is quite off target. You'll reach the next bit of pressure before, provided you can do that, before someone else. And it allows you to link up these, you know, which we'll talk a lot about in the weather sections, but allows you to link up these two bits of pressure that someone else may not have got. If you can imagine being a little bit faster as well, then obviously that, you know, accelerates that opportunity and accelerates the reward. And if you're in a sea breeze kind of day where it actually mathematically works out better to be sailing high in the sea breeze, because the pressure is moving, you know, they're bigger bulges of pressure and they're moving slowly. Typically, it's good if you can sail high, you just keep getting rewarded. And in all the America's Cup testing I've done, you always win a test by sailing high in a sea breeze, and you generally will win a test sailing fast when it's changeable.
Oh, right. Okay. That's a good rule of thumb. Now, when you were so fast with Dave Barnes in the 470, I didn't have you down as a particularly heavy crew. How did your crew weight fit in with the rest of the fleet? Because how do you manage to go lower and faster without being relatively heavy?
I think it's the way you set the whole boat up, you know, that we were heavy enough. And once you reach that tick, you know, then you've got to look at, you know, how you set the boat up and, you know, how do you lower the center of effort. And one of the things we did was rake. You know, we brought rake in a big way, mast rake, and we straightened the exits of our sails more. So we didn't have as much return in the leech, which allowed the boat to go forward. And one of the things not many people know about actually is that we learned to sail with the centerboard down, not just down, but we learned to sail with the centerboard forward. And because it was designed and built by Dave Mackay actually, in such a way it twisted the tip of the centerboard when it got loaded, the bottom tip of the centerboard twisted to windward and gave us a huge leeway advantage once it was loaded. And the combination of that, all those factors, gave us that really extraordinary good speed in planing conditions.
And you were wearing weight in those days as well, but of course everyone else was, so I guess that sort of cancelled out. To carry that low mode, generally you do need to be a little bit heavier than most, don't you? The lighter sailors don't tend to have so many options.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you're right. The lighter sailors, if you're typically on the lighter side of your opposition, your options are height rather than speed, unless you've changed your rig. And there's typically a point where everybody's depowered, so there's kind of a bell curve you go through. And once, you know, everybody reaches, you know, just around full power and above, the heavy teams will go really well. Once everybody's starting to depower down the other side of the equation, and we talk a lot about that hinge setup, you know, once you're all on the depowered side, opening the hinge, then at equalize, the weight thing doesn't become such a problem. It's more about your technique and how you set your rig up.
Yeah, so that is the real problem area for some teams when some teams are holding on to those tight leeches in the full power conditions when others are having to depower and let go. That's the point of greatest weakness for them.
Yeah, that's when you lose your biggest delta, for sure.
Yeah. I wonder if Russ Clark would like to come in and make any comments that you want to make about the 505, or maybe Chris Loons, you would like to. So either of you guys, because then you've got the jibing board to think about as well. So here we've got Russ and we've got Penny in the background. Good evening, guys.
Hello.
So you've been getting to grips with the 505 for the last couple of years. I don't know if you'd had prior experience of jibing boards before then, but Penny, you campaigned 470s and of course been to the Olympics in the laser radial as well. Russ, you sent me a picture of you watching Road to Gold the other day on your hiking bench on the OK, so multitasking. Very, very impressive indeed. Did you manage to sit through the whole of Chapter 5 whilst hiking?
I did want to have my curry in between bouts of being on the hiking bench, but yeah, I'm at the early stages of building that endurance, I think.
Right.
Probably section one of chapter two.
Dominic, I see there's a supplementary question. We'll come back to that in a moment. But actually, maybe you want to address that, Penny and Russ, because you'll have experience here as well. And we'll ask Hamish afterwards as well. Is there an answer to Andy's question on the 49er centre board to raise or not raise it for footers? So we'll ask what you think, and then we'll see if it squares with what Hamish thinks. So Penny, you go first. That question of whether or not to raise the 49er centre board.
It was certainly my experience coming from a little bit of FX sailing where the rig's much smaller. And therefore we did raise the centre board as it got breezy, just because you didn't need all that centre board and it allowed you to free up and drive through the water. So yeah, definitely in the FX with the smaller rig.
But the other part of Dominic's question really is, would you have that board up from the start, from before the start, or would you consider having the board further down because you've got to get off the start in the first place? That's the other part of this question that makes it much harder.
Yeah, I mean, definitely for me, I'm always keen to link the start strategy to the race strategy, which I know we're not onto that part of Road to Gold yet, but then that comes into the modes and how you're going to set up. So if you think you've got the right mode to sail fastest around the race course, then you can link that into your start strategy. And we all know people who might favour starting to leeward of the fleet in order to give themselves the space, and how does that then link in with where you want to go on the race course. So, you know, and you see it when you watch some of the Olympic races now that are absolutely brilliant. There's always footage of them online in the medal races. People actually aren't afraid to start on port anymore. So if it's a right-hand racetrack, but that you want to get your bow down and get out there fast, start on port behind the fleet, pop out at the starboard end. That might be a strategy, and it would enable you to already be set up in the right mode. And, you know, as a sailor, I hate being dictated to by other people. I want to go where I want to go in the mode that I want to go, because I believe it's the fastest and best way around the race course. So, yeah, I would absolutely advocate we would never have changed the centreboard setting in order to get off the start line.
Very interesting. And Paul Brotherton was exactly the same. I mean, it looked crazy, him having half his board up as he went off a 49er start line, but he won a European championship. You know, he was right up there at the front of the fleet, and he never compromised on his board setting. So we've got some answers for you so far, Dominic. Let's go to Russ and see if the other half of that team agrees.
Yeah, certainly. You know, Andy, we've got experience in the Musto skiff where there's a bit of debate there, but I think if there's an option, I'd rather set myself up for being in the conditions in my own race pace halfway up the first beat early and get settled into that. So I'd go with that on the foil in that kind of boat. But if I go back to the first point of the question, if you're happy, Andy, about jibing boards and lifting and so on. So going back to, I think it was chapter one, where we were talking about kit and sort of one designs and so on. The 5.0's evolved to about four main producers of 5.0's now. And so we went for one of those. So we went for a pretty new top spec. You know, it's what the world championship winners in 2018 were sailing. So that was our datum from there, which brought us into the world of jibing boards, which we hadn't used before. So a little bit of research online, and there's not a lot. Yes, there's way less information about that kind of boat than there is about, you know, more standard production kit. So we asked around, but I suppose we've gone through a bit of a journey with it where we asked the world championship, the world champions, which was Holger Jess and Wolfgang Hunger, who are fabulous and just sort of imparting knowledge on us. And they were very much, you know, the beauty of the jibing board for us is as we raise it, it's got little notches on the back of the board. So as it comes into the box, it then reduces the angle from about 3.5 degrees to probably less than a degree. So as you go faster, the jibe effect is less. But most of the time when you really want to use it, you're in that full power sort of 10 knots, 12 knots condition, board vertical. So we've stuck with that and sort of just learned to use it. For us, psychologically, we put a bit of, you know, we like going for the bow down mode when we can, but we seem to have a good high lane. But we talked about our training partners with Ben and Roger earlier. And rather than go through the complication, I'm probably going to spill their secrets here, but they've told everyone anyway. But rather than go through the complication of trying to work out whether you have the board fixed, because we can also adjust various pins of board height and whether we want it to jibe or not, they've built up the front of their board so it doesn't jibe anymore. It's just a fixed board. And so they just
and just clarify who you're talking about, Ben and Roger are, and what have they done?
So Ben McGrane and Roger Gilbert, the current European and national champions, you know, superstar sailors in multiple classes, both of them are helms, both of them are crews. But what they did when they jumped in the 5A, they bought good production kit, they found out what everyone else was doing, and then they simplified it for themselves. So it took some of the risk away. So they sail very smart. They're always in the right place on the racetrack. By their own admission, they're not the fastest in the world, but they know how to get the most out of the boat in those kind of conditions. So they took away an option and they built up the front of their board so it doesn't jibe anymore. And they took that forward and they were injecting things they've learned from international 14s and other classes and just trying to keep it into the simple mode. And I'll probably stop there.
Amazing. So maybe the whole jibing board is a red herring. It just happened to be used by the best sailors, and therefore everyone else thought they needed to have one too. Maybe Chris Loons, if you want to drop a comment into the text box and see if you agree with the jibing board, if you think the jibing board's essential or if it's a red herring. But what's your view on that, Russ? Do you think the jibing board is essential or not necessarily?
So, you know, if I'm honest, we've probably got about 500 hours experience with the jibing board. And we, you know, I had the pleasure last year of being able to sail with people like Howie Hamlin out in the States and crewed for him. Paul Brotherton.
Howie Hamlin, again, just name drop. Howie Hamlin has done what?
He is a 18-foot skiff JJ world champion and a 5.0 world champion as well. And he's one of those guys who he records everything and he's very much a data man and fixed points. And so I've asked people like that, you know, what do you do? And that they all have a slightly different thing. It's like having the Lee Bao conversation in the bar after racing. You know, everyone has a slightly different view on it. And so we're sort of just taking the approach of what's the left of arc with the advice, i.e. you must do this and you have to have it in this certain condition. And then what's the right of arc, which is, you know, just pull it up and see what happens. And we sort of use a bit of analysis in between and personal experience. So we're on that learning curve at the moment, and we're still talking about how we use it in our boat. And probably the final point I would add on it is, you know, we've stuck to production kit at the moment. So the centerboard we have, we know is the largest it can be for the class. And yet sailing with the Americans last year, they use much thinner foils. They tend to sail in San Francisco and in breezy conditions. So they have much smaller foils. And sail with them in a slightly different way. So we're on that learning curve with it. So unfortunately, I'm not going to give you a straight answer if you do this and you do that, because there are too many variables in it. But we're just trying to keep it simple.
Yeah, well, I mean, great feedback, and interesting to hear what Roger and Ben are doing in the 505, what they always do, which is get into a complicated class and simplify it, just as they did with the International 14, just as they've done with the Merlin rocket. That seems to be their modus operandi. Chris Loons, what's your view on the whole debate about how to get off start lines and what kit you need to do that?
So I was just going to comment on the jibing board, really. We had in the first lockdown, we had the boat on the side, and we were looking at the movement of the board. And I think, like Penny and Russ, I think they might have a Holger Jess board, which we have. And it's got the lugs on that reduce the jibe. But actually, when we had the boat on the side and fiddled around with it, I didn't feel that they were particularly effective. So we actually went through the conversation of doing exactly what Roger and Ben have done. But in the end, I just ground the lugs off the back so the board jibes all the time. And actually, I much prefer it.
Okay.
Just for me, it just feels better. And it's helped me get a lower mode. I tend to sail a bit light, and getting a low mode is quite hard. But having those lugs off and the centreboard back just helped me out. So, yeah, just everyone, I guess, finds their way, don't they, to make it work.
Yeah, well, great feedback. Thank you very much, Chris, and thank you to the Clarks. So, Hamish, a lot of interesting stuff to pick up on there, but I just want to get your view, see if you agree with Penny about where to put a 49 aboard. Do you set it for the start, or do you set it for the race course?
I think definitely you're setting up for the first beat, you know, and maybe even towards the start of the first beat if you can be that accurate. You know, the pressure's there to actually jump out of the blocks, and if you can, you know, really have the boat tuned for the moment you pull the trigger, that's going to give you the best chance for a good result at the top mark, you know, finding clear air early. So, yeah, I totally agree. You're setting up for the conditions of the start, if you can fine tune it that well. And typically with a 49er, you know, your board, just as Penny said about the FX, is coming up as you depower. Like most classes, you're looking to reduce power underwater and in the aero above. So both options are good as you become overpowered. But I really like too the comments that have come through, and thanks to them. The simplicity is an important aspect to consider with tuning and everything you do around the race course, because you can make a poor decision, or you can lose concentration and hit a wave badly, or miss a moment when you should have tacked in terms of a lane, available lane, and all those things do count a huge amount towards race speed. And so therefore the whole idea of simplifying or having a good solid system that allows you to still race well heads up is really important in this chapter.
Thank you for that. Now I'm going to ask our host Benedict if you can try and bring up that document that Kevin Kenny has put together, and we might come back to that as and when we see that document. So Benedict, you can tell me on WhatsApp if that's not going to work, or you can tell me in the chat box. But Kevin has put an incredible amount of work into producing this cheat sheet that he's a dinghy sailor by background, but now sailing a keelboat with his mates, and they don't have that same dinghy background, so he wants to produce this cheat sheet to help them understand about the pivot point that we talk about in great depth in race five, and so that they can understand how their crew movement around the boat can help affect that pivot point while they're changing modes through the race course. So if I can show that to you in a little bit, I will. We've got oh, okay, may not be able to. I wonder if you can let me share my screen, then maybe I can do it through my screen. So if you give me the rights to do that, let's see if I can find it. So,
yeah,
Hamish, can you see that?
Yeah, that's worked.
And Kevin, if you want to come in and talk on this yourself, you'd be very welcome. And it's a fantastic document that you've put together. So if you're watching this and you haven't yet been through race five and you don't know what we're talking about with the pivot point, Hamish, just give us a brief explanation of what we mean by the pivot point for any given boat.
Yeah, well, it's the ultimate VMG weight distribution point. So you're, and as we talk a lot about the fact in this previous chapter, as the boat speed increases, that point, the perfect position of your weight fore and aft and laterally sideways changes. So you're constantly adjusting it. And this table is given, you know, a good insight into all the different things you can change and the effect they have on height and speed. So it's a good, I think it's a really good summary of what we were talking about in the previous chapter and makes a lot of sense going into this chapter on speed, race speed, you know, because it tells you how do you maintain those lanes amongst boats that are going both either faster and slower or faster and lower or higher and slower. So it's pretty much the tables are higher and faster, which is pointing and speed. And the feeling of where they're home. So, yeah, it's pretty good. Good summary.
Yeah, well, Kevin, you were concerned about that going up if it was incorrect, but we did have a look through it before we came live on the call, and Hamish was pretty happy with what you produced. So I think you've nailed it, and I hope you find that useful. The other suggestion I made to Kevin, not entirely tongue-in-cheek, was if you're dealing with people that haven't got that instinct for the pivot point because they've not got that dinghy sailing background, then maybe a good weekend to spend would be to have some beer racing in some lasers, and you know, put some beers at the end of the racetrack and sit your mates in some lasers and see who can work out how to get that laser from one end of the race course to the other and incentivize it. You'll know from following Road to Gold that Hamish is all about creating competition, even when you're training and even on every tuning run, to make sure that you take it as seriously as you can, but also to make sure you're having fun. So I would say if you're working with people on board a keel boat that have never sailed in dinghies, one of the best things you can do is to put them in dinghies, and that instinct for how to move your body around the boat will accelerate so much more quickly than if you spent the next 10 years still racing keel boats. Would you agree with that, Hamish?
Yeah, I think so. And I think another option we explored with the America's Cup this winter was putting all of the, because you've got to imagine there's a bunch of grinders, half the team, who are incredible athletes but may not have sailed before in the America's Cup as well. And certainly in our team, we've got a bunch of athletes that have never sailed before. Incredible athletes, but not sailors. And we mixed them up with our New Zealand Olympic team squad in these little boats, little sports boats called Elliots. So we distributed them amongst the 12 Elliots, and we created these 12 teams with everybody mixed up. And we had this race series once a month through the winter during this COVID lockdown. And it was really successful because they got to see how everyone else, I think they were, we had, the teams were up four because these guys were so big. I think we limited it to four. And we ended up, you know, they ended up learning a huge amount just being on board and hearing the chat and why this was happening and why that was happening, as opposed to being in your own boat, locked in, trying to figure it out yourself. So often, you know, that sharing of information that's provided within a crewed environment can be a faster track to learning than it is if you're just sailing alone. And I do always recommend within the Road to Gold that you do diversify and you do cross-train, you know, try to get involved in as much other sailing as you can. It's great opportunities for learning amongst the best in other classes. So just, you know, spread yourselves around.
Yes, and also one of the points we make in Chapter 5 is spread yourself around your own boat. So if you normally helm, then try crewing and vice versa. And if you're in a squad, then maybe swap personnel between teams and see what the communication differences are and the movements around the boat. And also swap equipment. And Well, from my experience, I've done very little of that in my sailing career. I feel like I probably missed out. Can anyone put their hand up and honestly say that they've done that on a regular basis? And I mean, John Emmett, you've worked at the highest level, but you've worked in single handers, so a lot of these options don't exist. You can't swap a helm and a crew because you're only a helm. But for swapping equipment, even in a boat as simple as a laser, how much do you find out by that diversification? Give us the forms of diversification that are available to you as a single-handed laser sailor.
I mean, I'd say that the Ilka class is in a really, really good place at the moment because a lot of the kit has now been standardized. But if you go back, there was a period of time where there was quite a lot of difference in the mast rake, which obviously makes a massive difference. And also the aluminium foils with the weight. You know, top mast, which had a 10% weight difference. So it made a big difference. And for the Olympics, we would always want to do training in the boat that was going to be the same boat as they're going to race at the Games. So for Weymouth, you know, we had North Sails with huge, great big sort of logos on them. So it was actually very different to the Hyde. I don't know how, you know, there used to be so much difference, but there definitely was. And when you have supplied equipment, but bringing your own sail, you still want to test your sails because there's tolerances there. And if it's the one European Championship that year, you want to bring your best possible sails. So we'll go out, try a few sails, and the least favourite one gets put down to training, and the most favourite one gets to go and do a championship.
Yeah, okay. And I noticed you corrected me on Ilka. We have to call it an Ilka now.
To be honest, I'm still finding it very hard to get it right. And I'm sure everybody knows what we're talking about. But yeah, the molds now, all the new builders basically have the same mold. They were all shipped out right in the beginning of the COVID crisis. So hopefully everything's going to be a lot more standard going forward. And certainly with the radial, when you've got both sections being composite, the lower and the top, I see that as a really, really good thing.
Now, I see we've also got a Lily as part of our group this week, but I don't know if it's your Lily, John. But if, stay with us for a moment.
I can't claim ownership. I was told a long time ago by a man poking me in the chest that she was property of China. But yeah, that is Li Jiaoshu.
Oh, that is. OK, well, one or the other of you, I wonder if you can help us with a question that Alex has, who sails a Finn, and he sails in Enoshima, interestingly. Now, he's got a struggle sailing in bad waves upwind. Now, he weighs 99 kilos and he reckons he's above average for his fitness and confident in his hiking. He's got a rig that's on the soft side and a deep and very powerful sail, but he's considering buying a stiffer mast because his fitness level has improved and therefore he can hike harder. But he fundamentally has a problem with getting the boat through bad waves upwind, which is why when he asked me that, I asked him how much he weighed. Well, 99 kilos sounds like it should be enough. But what would be your advice, John or Lily, on how you address that boat speed deficit in those conditions?
Do you want to go ladies first?
You're on, John, so you go first.
All right, OK. I would have thought it's probably more about twist. So, you know, a very, very simple rule of thumb. If you've got, you know, flat water, you're looking at a flat sail and a tight leech. And if you're talking about the Enoshima waves, you want quite a lot of twist. So you can be steering the big angles to keep the bow in contact with the water. So it's not just a question about power. That's what I would have thought. So it's the mast stiffness is probably more dictated by his weight because you want to be competitive throughout the range of conditions. But yeah, probably setting up with more twist. And we always find that really difficult to do in a laser, which is why we end up playing the sheet.
Right, because you just haven't got the range of controls available to you as you would in a fin.
And that's why the people who can stay two block in those conditions, they do have a big advantage, but if you try and stay two block when you shouldn't be, then it's massively slow.
Right, okay, yeah, got it. If Lily wants to come in, she's very welcome to do so. So I'll just see if Lily can come in.
Yeah.
Hi, Lily.
Thanks I'm for coming doing in. Weymouth, whereas Jones in Lanzarote now. John spent how many flights? 6 flights. Finally made it to Lanzarote.
Oh wow, there's a whole other story right there. But on this on this question of getting upwind in the big waves of Enoshima or the also choppy waves, what's your answer for Alex?
I think naturally I quite like sailing in big waves and then probably smooth movement and then also frequent sheeting with steering, but not so aggressive, will fit better in those wavy conditions. Whereas in the choppy water, then you need to be more aggressive and explosive. I don't have much experience in the non-design class, because even though I sailed 1 or 2 years in Europe class, I just feel I'm not very good in those equipment configuration, and then also for the Europe, probably I'm not good enough to have customized masts as well as the sails. So the moment when I switched to the laser radio, I just said, much better, so that I can just focus purely on sailing and improving my techniques without worrying about the equipment.
I suppose that is one of the beauties of the One Design. John talked about the difficulties of it, that if you need to ease your blocks,
Also what Joelaire said before, because Joelaire was sailing laser radio together with me campaigning for Beijing. And then later on, after she switched for 70, and she said, in the laser, probably we spent hours and hours like trying to get fitter in the gym, whereas sailing the 470, just hours in the boat park, sorting out the equipment.
Right. Anyway, you found what you preferred, which was to be out on the water. Lily, thank you very much for that. And thank you, John. And Hamish, I went to them first because they are single-handed experts, but I know you're going to have a view on this, even though you've never attempted to race a fin at world-class level yourself. What would be your input for Alex?
I mean, it's a good question. I do recall chatting about this in Road to Gold. The fact is, you know, if you can eliminate the confusion around equipment and developing equipment, you know, you're going to be able to focus more on technique, and there's often gains there. And we have chatted a lot about that. And I remember when I was doing those three Olympic campaigns with a British team, I noticed that that Ben, for instance, stayed with the same mast over the two Olympic cycles I was with them. He used Ian Percy's stuff and then went on to continue to use it. And it just simplified his whole campaign. He just said, okay, the boat and the mast is what it is, and I'm going to, you know, make a sail fit that mast that will work for me. While I'm lighter, he had obviously a flatter sail, and then as he developed the weight to where he wanted it, he went with a more conventional sail, and he focused on developing better and better techniques in the class. And there's often more on the table to be taken around techniques, and it's very easy to be looking for a silver bullet and not finding or not realizing what's obviously in front of you where your biggest gains are.
Yeah, I think that's the point that we continue to make on Road to Gold. And one of the other things we talk about on the race speed chapter is to train in chaos as well. Just because a tuning run doesn't feel like it's taking place in clinical conditions where the breeze isn't absolutely steady and someone looks like they're lucking in because they've got the inside of a lift or something, doesn't mean that you should stop the tuning run. Just tell us about what you learn about speed other than what settings to put your mast pins on. What are the other benefits of those kind of tuning sessions?
I think it's really important to try to simulate your racing as much as you can. And the tuning run is a great way to sort of eliminate, and which is the previous chapter, sort of to step through things to try to figure out what particular, drilling down deeper into what particular thing is making you faster or slower. But when you get into this race speed, you really need to simulate racing. And I often just chat to the group and say, okay, we've got this kind of day, you know, It's a matter of, let's say, winning the left or winning the right, or it's a case of getting on the first shift. You know, how can we simulate training to really reward those characteristics of the day? So if you're kind of bringing it back all the time to how do you win that day, how do you win on this particular race course? You know, if it's Palmer and it's enclosed R&L there, you know, you need to be able to get to the left. You know, so, you know, we talked about the offset top mark is a great way, which, you know, you're only left with 30 seconds on the table on port tack, you know, so you really have to be able to, you know, jump out of the blocks on starboard. You need to be able to, and it also, you know, means you've got to find a good, you've got to be into an early jibe and find a good lane back, you know, with the asymmetrical. So it puts a lot of pressure around that particular aspect of racing. And I think if you're constantly drilling into how to win on a, we've just talked about it in general terms, but on a sea breeze day when it's really rewarding, sailing high, and on a gusty, shifty day when it's really rewarding being fast, it's really important to try to simulate that chaos within your training and your testing.
And one of the other points that came home to me was the ability of the really good sailors to ignore the other boats when you think that you're going to fall into the bad air of the other boat. That's when you hold your nerve. And you talk about rubber banding, and maybe the rubber band is stretching in their favor, but if you stick with it and hold your nerve, then the rubber band will come back in your favor. But if you start panicking and start changing the way that you're sailing the boat, maybe you start inadvertently pulling the main sheet in a little bit too hard or steering the boat, you're just looking over your shoulder at that other boat too much, you are going to lose to that other boat. So psychologically, that's a really challenging element of living in thin lanes. But again, that's why we talk about train hard, fight easy. You learn to live in those thin lanes by sailing in these compromised tuning runs, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the better you get, the more you challenge yourself. And that's the point. That's why people do get better. And, you know, if you can set up in the middle of those tuning runs rather than on the outside, you're always going to be more challenged. And you're dead right. If you can just eliminate, just psychologically completely eliminate that boat to leeward and keep, you know, putting your boat in the right pivot and in the right position on the waves and just, you know, accelerating at the right time around the pressure. It's very, very obvious when somebody gets mentally affected by the boat to leeward and they start reacting to that boat as opposed to reacting to their own boat. And therefore they're putting their own boat in a compromised position speed-wise, and you'll just see them just charging towards the boat to leeward. You know, if they can ignore that boat to leeward and just react to their own boat, they'll live there for a lot longer, maybe forever. And so it is a real head game, how to overcome that psychologically.
You were talking about that interesting mode that you and Dave Barnes had in the 470 of having great height, even though you were sort of footing. I mean, if you'd given that boat perfectly set up to somebody else, or let's say Dave stepped out of the boat and another helm jumped in and you were telling him, right, you've got to point your bow at the boat to leeward, that psychologically that must be quite difficult to get used to if you're not used to that sort of footing mode to gain height. That seems a bit counterintuitive.
Yeah, I remember Russell Coutts telling me too that, you know, with the Oracle campaign when they, you know, when they cleaned up Team New Zealand from 8-1 or whatever it was in San Francisco, you know, at one point they said to Jimmy, if, you know, like, if you don't steer the boat 10 degrees lower, you're not steering tomorrow. You know, it got to that point, you know, that the performance guys could clearly see that they needed to go faster and lower and get on the foils up when, if they were going to beat Team New Zealand in San Fran. So there's a really clear example where it was obvious from the outside that the coaching performance group could see exactly what was going on, and people on the boat just couldn't get out of where they were because that's how they've always done it.
And I remember you could hear it on the comms watching those races, that when Ben Ainslie was brought on board as a tactician, even Ben Ainslie, the Finn sailor, was telling Jimmy Spithill to bear away and get the boat moving. So that was Ben's instinct as well. Anyway, thank you for that. Now, we talk a lot about upwind living in thin lanes. But Jan Willem sent us in a question. He wants a suggested exercise to train thin lanes downwind. So his question is, and Jan Willem, you're very welcome to come in on this if you'd like to. Could you help me with a drill for our squad of 2 to 3 boats to test the low? Oh, here you are, Jan Willem. So why don't you put the question? Nice to meet you. And fire away.
Thanks.
Tell us.
Yeah, we are setting a catamaran with just the main and a jib sheet. And we've been practicing a lot on using much more our weight in the offset mark, so getting into the downwind. So we can really create a low mode there. But especially in the whirls where we are like 100, 120 boats on the are there, and it's very close at the first stop mark. So you can actually get down low, but then you have the effect of the whole train coming, creating a lot of bad air. So, I mean, then maybe this is something that we will address in the tactics, so in one of the next chapters. But can you survive there? Can you survive in that thin lane, just below the whole train, the downwind train that keeps the higher angle?
Oh. Hamish, far away. What do you reckon?
That's a really good point. I mean, we focus a lot on getting that slingshot around that offset mark. You need, the better you can leave that mark, the faster you can be arriving at the mark, the better you're going to leave the mark. So if you really put a lot of effort on getting as fast as you possibly can before the offset mark, that'll often mean that you end up down the ladder run a little bit better than the boats around you. And that's if that first jump is a little bit like the start again. The first jump allows you to set up a little bit, just a little nudge better, and a little nudge better than everyone else. And you'll find that the walls start opening. You feel like you're moving forward on them because you've got more space, and it's like a snowball going down the hill. You gain more momentum, and vice versa. If you sort of poorly execute either the start or that slingshot around the offset mark, you've got that slightly compromised position near other boats, and then the walls start closing in on you, and you have to react more to them and not to what your boat wants, and then it exaggerates everything, and you start to slow down more. So it's really important to give yourself the best chance at that mark, because it's like a new start. And then the faster you go, the better you can make that turn, the better you make that turn in terms of how much you can turn down before you you have to turn up again to keep your speed, that you'll just move another boat length or two from your opposition, give yourself a bit more space, and then keep working on it from there.
And Hamish, if Jan Willem is working in a group of just two or three, and he's trying to replicate a scenario that has in excess of 100 boats and all the mess that goes with that, is that achievable? Can he come up with an exercise that's going to help him with that?
Well, I think those hockey pucks are quite useful, to really work out how to achieve your best speed on that sort of 90 degree reach. You need to be able to get, as fast as you possibly can. If there's space to do that, obviously if you're running into the back of someone, that's a different thing, but if you're just out on your own, trying to play with the idea of getting as fast as you possibly can, hockey puck will give you that top speed with the GPS, and then how you turn the boat down is so important as well. Just making those right changes to sort of soak down, and how fast you turn your turning circle with the rudder, all those things will contribute to a better turn down. So I think that's a really important thing to just dissect a bit more, because that's your starting point. And then obviously how you play the game around the other boats in the next phase is important, and that'll be addressed more in the tactical sections later.
So those hockey pucks, I haven't used them myself, but I'm sure there's quite a few people that have done so, sort of small GPS trackers. If anyone wants to drop into the chat box what they use and what they like, whether it's a Garmin or whatever other ones there are, that would always be useful to see. Now we've got some other questions coming in. Let's have a look. Let's go to Natalie. Is there any differentiation in centreboard height between a 4.7 radial or standard due to difference in sail plan in terms of how you lift the centreboard? So John, I don't know if you want to, if you know the 4.7 well enough, but is there any difference in centreboard height?
I'm really happy to answer this one because it's a very, very easy question. Lasers just go sideways like nothing else on earth. I did a bit of stuff with Ian Percy before the 2000 games. I was there in my radial and I was the rabbit every tuning run, and I just felt myself sliding into the fins every single time. So no, in any laser you have the centreboard down all the time because there's just so much leeway. So that's a very easy one. I mean, fundamentally the 4.7 is going to be pretty underpowered for the amount of hull you've got, and the standard rib can be quite overpowered for the amount of hull, but it doesn't make any difference. And I just realised earlier I was trying to keep things simple, but in terms of the waves, the frequency of the steering is dictated by the length of the wave, and actually the size of the steering you do is dictated by the wave height, because you can go to venues where you have short waves that are very high or long waves that aren't actually that big. And that's why Japan's such a great venue, because you get short chop on top of ocean swell. So really technically interesting.
Okay, great. Lovely answer from you. Thank you very much, John. So thank you, Dominic, for dropping in the kind of speed puck that they use in windsurfing. Let's go to another question from Kevin. We discussed different modes for asymmetric spinnakers downwind. In the J70, we do wing on wing in about 8 to 13 knots of wind in flat water. Do any other asymmetric classes use this mode? So do you ever go wing on wing in the 49er, for example, Hamish?
Well, there might be an opportunity, and that's interesting. You know, there's a moment there when you're trying to get to the bottom mark and you're sort of stuck in the middle. I've seen it work, you know, surprisingly.
In a 49er?
Maybe not intentionally.
Well, wow.
You know, in light air, you know, you can get stuck in the middle of the gate. And sometimes I've seen it happen. I don't know whether it's been intentional, but sure, it's not a mode for the 49er. It's interesting that it can work.
Kevin, I've just seen you crop up on video. If you'd like to come in, you're very welcome.
Sure, that'd be great. And Hamish, that's exactly how I learned it too. We were flying in, amateur team. We were ecstatic. We were like fifth or sixth. And suddenly a world champion threw his boom over and was now starboard. And so totally blocked, took out the entire approach into the leeward mark or gate. And we were just, you know, flabbergasted. I think we broached immediately because we had to avoid hitting him. We just had never seen it. And then a year later, we noticed that in flat water in Tampa, that guys were doing almost the whole leg wing on wing in certain puffy conditions. And you would literally jive out of wing, go over, catch another lane, go into wing again. And all of a sudden we're like, wait a second, this boat was never designed for wing. And they were doing almost 2/3 to 3/4 of the leg in wing mode.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I Kevin, I can send you an interview that I did with Ben Saxton, one of our top sailors in the UK, who has done a lot of J70 sailing. And I asked him about the wing on wing. I think he won the event in Miami last year as part of the crew. And he told me about how they used it tactically at the windward mark to get separation from the rest of the fleet, a bit like what Hamish was answering Jan Willem just now in the Dart 18, and also to gain tactical advantage at the leeward gate as well. But yeah, I mean, using it for 2/3 of the run, that is incredible.
We were winning the Corinthians last year, and you know, I wish I would have pulled this trick. And of course, the two leaders kept going out to the corner, and you guys were talking about beware of the ley line. And had I remembered, we should have gone right into this mode and controlled the opposition as the opposition sailed out because we were in first place. But instead, we launched a jibe and they went further and they came in faster and we had to throw one extra jibe and we literally lost the Corinthians by a pole length.
Wow! Oh, that's gutting. Well, you'll know what to do next time.
I know, these are just this different way to play the game.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a crazy game changer. And some of the asymmetric classes in the UK have actually banned wing on wing because it was too powerful a move. And they decided that's not why they went asymmetric racing. So it's actually not allowed in some classes.
Wow.
I love it. I love it. Anyway, I'll send you that article. And Silke, yes, happy to send you that article from Ben Saxton as well. Now, we are beginning to run out of time. But if you want to drop in any last questions, please do. Leif Jagerbrand, I'm sorry if I've just murdered your Swedish name. You're very welcome to come in and correct me on the pronunciation of your name. And maybe you want to ask your question directly if you'd like to join us.
Yes.
Hi, Leif. How do we say your name?
Good enough. I understood that you meant me. So, yeah. That was good. Yeah. So tell me,
what are you? A very interesting question you got. So, firstly, tell us what's your reasons for asking it?
Yeah. So I have a Figaro 3. I live in Sweden, and I aim to do a run for the Olympics in the mixed offshore. So that's my background. And my question is, if you were to make a road to gold for offshore mixed, or anyone aiming to do the classic 600 nautical mile keelboat races shorthanded, which additional chapters would you add, and how would you rank them versus the chapters that you already have in the course?
I think it's a really good question, and it's interesting. You know, it's highlighted a number of this. Little course has highlighted a number of deficiencies, and I'm thinking ahead that, you know, you've pointed one out, and it's a really good one, and there's every reason for us to add a chapter. And and answering your question, I'd say, you know, the offshore is provides a great opportunity with navigation, you know, so you're digging deeper into the whole wind thing and understanding all the tools that you have to be able to plot your course offshore to take advantage of changes, you know, diurnal changes when the wind changes at night. And, you know, 600 miles is going to be a real opportunity to dig deeper into those kind of tools. And, in fact, we're going to have John Bilger on the course. He's with PredictWind, and he's made a real good attempt at a tool with PredictWind that enables you to do that kind of plotting, you know, according to the wind grip files. And he'll explain it a lot better than I can. But with my offshore cruising, I do a lot of it as well. So I do understand a little bit. And I think I would be doing, within that chapter, I'd be doing a lot more work on using those tools and getting amongst the, I'm not sure if you're following the Vendee at the moment, the round alone. Yeah, so it's really important. Those kind of things are really, really good opportunities to learn. And I think with most of those, certainly with the Volvo, you can there's a race that you can do watching, using a tool, plotting your own, navigating your own boat in simulation. Also a really, really good learning tool.
Like the other... Obviously, big challenge for the double-handed for the Olympics is you don't know what kind of boat that you're going to end up competing in. So our chapter one is all about selecting the right equipment. Now, you've got a Figaro 3. It sounds like that's probably in the right ballpark, but who knows? Who knows what kind of boat they're going to end up choosing for you? So Hamish, when you don't even know what your weapon of choice is going to be, how do you structure your campaign in that situation?
Yes, yeah, that's right. I mean, you have to have your best guess, and it's going to come down a lot. It's going to come down to how you can work with your team, how you can get the best out of each other all the time. So, you know, a lot of the Road to Gold does a good job with building a team and understanding how to build that team. And I think you can get on with all that in any kind of boat, as long as it's somewhere near them. The ball, the mark of where you're going to end up. And when do we find out about the class, you know?
Leif, do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, they will announce it 1 year before the Olympics. Roughly.
Okay.
Yeah. And the idea, as I understand it, is to reduce the sort of the money gap, the affordability gap between the emerging nations and the established sailing nations. But I've heard a good argument that having this late reveal of what kind of equipment you're going to use is probably going to have the opposite effect. And it's probably going to make it even more of a rich man and woman's game by leaving the choice so late. But coming back to what Hamish said earlier, the more diversification you can bring into your sailing in whatever form that is, I would say that applies even more with your challenge of where you're sailing blindfold, not quite knowing what piece of equipment you're going to be given. Just get yourself into as many different types of 30-foot keelboat that you can, if that is the size range that they're talking about. Just broaden your experience, because I remember how the Australians going into the London 2012 Olympic Games, people like Tom Slingsby doing the Etchells World Championships, crewing for John Bertrand and winning the Etchells Worlds, Nathan Outeridge sailing in an SB20 three-person keelboat and doing the 505 Worlds and then dominating the 49ers at London 2012. It seemed like that process of diversification, of exposing yourself to as many different types of sailing as you can, absolutely worked for them when it came to getting back and doing their day job of winning Olympic medals in their chosen class. We are coming to the end, but Dominic, I'm going to finish off with your question. It's another technical one about if you could change centreboard depth downwind in an asymmetric like a 49er, would you go for more power or less drag?
Good question. I mean, the days that I sailed the 18-foot skiff, where it was an open class and we could do anything we wanted. And I remember we always had a different centreboard height for the different rig heights we had. So we had four different rig heights we developed, and each centreboard had a different height as well, corresponding to the rig height. So I think the short answer is you would definitely go shorter as the breeze increased, and longer as the breeze decreased. Given that, so I think you know that the you want to generate more power, you're going to want a deeper centreboard.
Okay, more power, deeper centreboard. But I mean, for sure, people are pulling up their boards in strong winds, and that it's working in the 49er, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. As I know that it does in the Musto skiff, and it certainly works in the International 14 and pretty much every other high performance class that I've sailed as well. So we've gone slightly past time. I hope you've enjoyed that. So for those of you that are fully up to date on Road to Gold, I hope you've enjoyed the first five chapters. It's quite a step change as we go into chapter six, isn't it, Hamish? Because we are now getting to the decision-making point of things. And Penny Clark touched on this earlier with her answer about where you set your daggerboard. Well, she pretty much said, well, you don't know where to put your daggerboard until you know what your game plan is for the rest of the race. That's what I find so fascinating about the way that you've structured Road to Gold, is that you've put the building blocks in the order that you have, because you want to go into the decision-making chapters as fully armed to the teeth as you can, with the right kit, the right fitness, the right ability to get the boat around the race course with great boat handling, and that all knits together with the boat speed that we've talked about in two chapters. And now we start to look at how you use all those tools to take your all those weapons onto the racetrack and the decisions that you apply on the racetrack. So we're getting to one of the most exciting parts of Road to Gold next week with starting. Hamish, anything you want to say about that before we sign off?
No, that was a great summary, Andy. Well done.
Well, thank you very much. And I've really enjoyed our journey so far, and I hope you have. Wherever you are on the Road to Gold, you do it in your own time. I know that in the UK, we're all champing at the bit to go racing again. So there's no better time right now to be learning about your craft through this online course than there is now. And I hope you're getting a lot out of it. tell your friends and keep on coming back to these live calls. We really enjoy them and we appreciate the feedback. Thanks very much. Have a great week, and we will see you this time next week when we will be looking at chapter 6 of Road to Gold. Thanks very much.
Thanks, everyone.